You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Meet the Farmers. Today I'm at Lauriston Farm in Essex speaking to Spencer Christie, who is the farm's director. Lauriston is a 210-acre farm and is managed under biodynamic principles, with about 85% of the farm designated a site of special scientific interest. As you know, Meet the Farmers is all about presenting the breadth of the farming world, and in this spirit, Lauriston Farm therefore isn't your average farm business, with the farm run as a charitable community benefit society. There are just under 160 shareholders, all of whom have a stake in decision making. And in terms of production, the farm raises sheep and cattle, as well as growing fruits, vegetables, and herbs. Spencer, thank you for speaking to me on what is... I mean, I'm still amazed that it's actually February, because it is a glorious, glorious day. Can you start by telling me a bit about the history of the farm and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, that could take a while. I suppose the first thing to say, we're not from a farming family. So I'm sort of the first generation that's farmed. You know, we're on the Blackwater Estuary, and I was born in Maldon, so this is very much sort of my patch, if you like. And my parents moved here in 87, just to the farmhouse. Then a few years later, maybe 5 years later, the land came up for sale, and they knew the farmer quite well, and they managed to get a mortgage on the land. There was sort of planning applications going in for industrial uses and sawmills and things, which would have really changed the whole interest in living here for my parents. So they they got a mortgage together and bought what was then 250 acres. And I was doing a PhD in conservation policy for agriculture at the time, and I'd done a degree in environmental science at UEA before that. So I always had a really keen interest in environmental issues, conservation side. And when I got this phone call from my dad, who was asking me these questions about what sort of conservation scheme is this, it's like, he's never interested in this.
What's going on?
Yeah, he's like, oh, I've just bought a farm. I said, I said, which farm? And he said, well, Lauriston Farm. Ah, that's good. So, yeah, and like I said to you, I think within about a week I was back here. But how do I get this thing started, you know? So I got a bit of money behind me, well, a little bit, you know, and I knew the farm needed livestock. So I wasn't ready to, I was early 20s and I really wasn't ready to settle down. I had a bit of travelling to do and I knew it has to have livestock, this farm. So to sort of cut a long story short, 2004 I actually started farming here and started from scratch. Did about a year's volunteering before it on other farms over the world. Had a bit of a travel, my last travel, before I settled down here.
Took the vow to livestock.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And sort of found permaculture and also found biodynamics on that travel.
Okay.
And so developed it from 2004 to onwards, reintroduced livestock, cattle and sheep. Learned everything from the bottom up. And then just 2 years ago, we formed the cooperative you mentioned for it, to take the farm into the future, really, take it into the next generation.
Tell me about that early interest in biodynamics and why you just took out of all the models, and there are lots of models even within organic agriculture, why did biodynamics interest you? Why did you think that was the way?
It's a funny one, you know, because I did this PhD down at Y College in Kent, and there was a small group of us there doing PhDs in organics, conservation farming, all those sorts of things. Never heard biodynamics mentioned, and yet 4 miles from us was the oldest biodynamic farm in the country, Perrycourt Farm, and which is an amazing place. It's subsequently been sold, but it was an incredible biodynamic farm. Never heard the word, you know. And it wasn't until I went travelling, and then I met somebody from Belgium who told me, said, oh, if you ever think about farming, just use biodynamics. And it's like, whoa, what's that? Never heard that word, but there's something about the word that interested me. And he just described it as, well, the thing that really drew him to it, he'd worked on a farm down in Gloucestershire for a couple of years, was he said you'd never have to worry about food security because the quality of the produce is so high, you have to eat so much less of it. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And So, and that was it. We sort of shook hands. Thanks for that information, party company. But it stayed with me. And then a bit like when you buy a new car, suddenly you see that car everywhere on the road. I went to New Zealand then and found biodynamic farms here, there and everywhere. And it just, yeah, there was something about the feel of the farm that when I went onto the farm. This doesn't feel like a farm, what I'm used to a farm feeling like. It had a different atmosphere to it. And then I came back to England and started looking around and going to a few farms here. And again, that same feeling of, there was a lot of people on the farms, yeah. which isn't something I've grown up with. Well, it's like sort of maybe two people, 1,200 acres and one tractor or two tractors, you know, it's sort of, for this model, this part, maybe 1,800 acres now is the model. Very, very different feel, lots of people. But the key bit, so somebody lent me the basic lectures from 1924 by Rudolf Steiner, and there's an introduction in that particular edition. And it said the two things a farmer needs, one, the farm has to have livestock for biodynamics, and the farmer must meditate. Right. I thought, well, I already do the second one, and I know this farm needs livestock. Eh? It has to have livestock for the conservation work we do. And there's a farming method that requires you to have livestock. It's like, okay. And that was it, really. I mean, I knew it from this guy when I met him, but when I just read those two key principles, you don't need like a business plan, you don't need this, that, and the other. It's just those two key things.
Yeah. And we featured a biodynamic farm on the podcast last year, Claw Hatch Farm in Sussex. Yeah, Gala was on that. For the benefit of listeners who haven't listened to that episode, please check it out, guys. What are the key principles and premises, would you say, behind biodynamics?
Yeah. Yes, it's like anything. It's almost impossible to put it into a little sentence or two. But
it's quite broad.
But the key, I think, from looking purely from like an agricultural side, this thing that there's an overriding principle within biodynamics, which says we aim to produce everything from within the farm. Okay, so there's this like in permaculture, they call it like closed loops. But it views the farm as a living organism, biodynamics. So it's not just in the physical realm. It's also actually in the spiritual realm as well. That this farm has a connection with the wider world, way beyond what we can perceive. But within its boundary, it's regarded as a living organism, not just like a dead, not just like a production. Sometimes I hear farms described, they sound more like factories, you know. But this is sort of viewed very much as a living entity. And with that ideal of producing from within, of course it's impossible, but we aim towards it. So simple things like, and the two key things are fertility and animal feeds. So we aim to produce those from within the farm. And as soon as you take on that type of principle, that's quite a challenge, you know. Yeah. But it defines the farm, and it gives a real taste of a locality as well. You're really working from the locality, you know, the soil of the farm. So there's that overriding principle that covers everything. There's also the requirement to have livestock, especially the rumen, so cow or sheep, ideally the cow, which is an interesting aspect to it as well. So again, we're sort of defining the farm here. It has to have livestock. So we can't, like a lot of organic farms, we just can specialise into cereals or livestock, whatever, and then like cross one with the other. Bring the fertility in. Whereas if we say we're bringing fertility into the farm, we would say actually the organism is sick in some way. So in addition to those principles, if you like, in practice, there's also two field sprays that are peculiar to biodynamics. One is made from horn manure, one is made from silica. The former really works on all soil life. The latter works on plant growth. Especially the ripening processes, photosynthesis respiration processes, increases those a lot, and other things. And then there's six other, they're all called preparations, and they're made from very common substances like stinging nettle, chamomile, oak bark, valerian. They're all prepared in special ways, but they go in the compost heap after they've been prepared. Without using those eight preparations, as they're called, you can't be certified as a biodynamic farm. So we get an annual inspection, and you can't use the DMESA trademark and this sort of thing. So that's a key part of it. In addition to that, it's not a requirement of the standards, but there's also most biodynamic farms will be working with planetary rhythms and lunar rhythms as well, which agriculture has always done.
Mm.
It's only very recently, you know, in probably my great-grandfather would, actually my grandfather would have been, he farmed in the war, he would have been using a little bit of that, maybe a little bit further back, definitely acknowledging those rhythms. But in the last 150 years or so, we've, in the West anyway, we've just thought it's complete poo-poo and thrown it out.
With that in mind, some farmers might push biodynamics aside as with the whole muck and magic sort of argument. With your environmental science background, I'm interested in your thought process behind some of those principles from a scientific point
of view. So I do have a scientific head, you know, and I can't, unless something works, I won't be using it, especially in farming. I mean, you know whether it works or not straight away. It's such a practical art, if you like. So when I started here, I had to find out, does this thing work or not? So for about 6 years, I trialled it and just following the prescriptions and getting a feel for it. And I noticed the change in the soil quality, earthworm activity in particular. And that's like a key indicator, you know. And then, after a couple of summers, then I did some trial planting with different moon phases and different lunar phases and this sort of thing. And I noticed the difference in germination rates. I noticed the difference in plant health, just enough for me to then pick books up.
Yeah.
And then I picked up books, and there's quite a lot of research, not much in this country, there's a lot from Germany in particular. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of it's been translated, but there's enough translated to help me to kind of verify what I was experiencing here. And then visiting other farms as well and seeing it. And then I suppose a big thing as well was when the wine industry embraced biodynamics.
Absolutely, because I would say because viticulture is by far and away the most significant biodynamic sector out there.
Yeah, that's right. And there you have professional tasters, that is, you know, using taste as the quality assessor. And when they talk about the taste of the soil, there's something different with the wines that they're drinking, they're tasting. And that was very interesting. And I've seen quite a lot of video footage of the transformation of the wineries. Like they can be small, large, often very small scale in France, like the difference. And then the neighbours would look over and say, oh, I want to do what you're doing, you know. And so it's sort of, we have these conversations often, where's the research? Where's the scientific research to show that this is working? Well, it's difficult to find a lot. There is some, there's enough for me anyway. But when we look at the results and the output and the changes in the farms where biodynamics is practiced, it's quite clear that something quite beneficial is going on. And there's a really interesting trial. The longest running trial comes from Switzerland, which is called DOK, the DOK trial. And I think it's in its 28th year now. And what they've shown there is they're comparing conventional organic and biodynamic. On a large, not a massive scale, but a large enough scale. And it's over that length of time, they're looking really at the humus layer in the soil. And as we know from organics, from the research from Newcastle of 3-5 years ago, that the organic system over time doesn't maintain the fertility. It nearly does, but not quite. And the conventional system really doesn't. You know, you have to really keep increasing the inputs, or keep fine-tuning the inputs and this sort of thing. Whereas the biodynamic system holds the fertility. And then the interesting thing with that DOK trial, after 21 years, there was a sudden jump that went on in the humus layer and other indicators of fertility. And it's sort of, you know, they're tiny jumps, but they say that something is going on, something different. And that's, you know, when it's rare to find a trial over that length of time. So I suppose with my scientific head on, the answer is I've seen it work in practice. I've experienced it on other farms. I've seen biodynamic produce win awards for taste and quality. But I've also seen enough scientific research, which has been replicated in other settings, to verify some of the use of these preparations, which is kind of the main core of the work. You know,
you mentioned that social aspect, the people bit. About biodynamic farms, which is certainly something that I find going on, so that people are very sad. There are more people generally on them. This morning you've had an open day. You have a whole host of volunteers. So tell me more about this charitable community benefit society. How does it work, and what is it?
Yeah, it's an interesting journey really, because we started, we formed it in February 2 years ago, so 17.
Yeah.
2017. But we started, me and my parents met in about 2015. So we started to have a conversation about succession and what happens next here. And I'd visited other community-owned farming. In the biodynamic world, it's quite common. There's a few farms in this country. There's many more farms in Western Europe. What I could see there is what you've described. Like, there's this sort of like this human aspect to the farm which grows. And there's a sense more of a locality. So you link in much more with your the people immediately living around you. Like, for example, we've got 160 members, over 80% of those are from Essex, which is, you know, it shows that this county is wanting what we're doing, you know, quite clearly. Running parallel to that, if you like, so there's the community farm ownership. There's also a movement that started in the 50s in a village called Camp Hill, which is near Aberdeen. And these are therapeutic communities. Again, it comes from the biodynamic work of adults with learning disabilities living and working with a host family on a farm, undertaking all aspects of the farm, day-to-day farm work, and processing farm produce. And that was something I first saw in North Yorkshire in Botton Village in 2010. And I was blown away by what I saw there. I couldn't believe it. It's five farms there in one dale. And I couldn't tell you who had learning disabilities and who didn't.
I really want to visit Botton.
Yeah, it's changed a lot today. It really has. The whole structure has changed enormously. There's now shift workers, there's now house parents, and it's really changed. But I was lucky enough to see that kind of original impulse of it. And I remember phoning my parents up and they said, "Wow, you have to see one of these places." So I took them down to Gloucestershire, to the Grange, which is much smaller, but the same thing going on there. And it was just, it's so inspiring. And it's actually that we're wanting to bring to this farm, what we're working towards. And one, like, the legal vessel for holding it is a community benefit society. It fits well. We have charitable status as well, because that enables us to apply for grants outside the agricultural sector. So all our objectives are charitable in nature. They've been passed by HMRC. And we get things like corporation tax relief through that status as well. And one of the key pushes for that was the vote for the referendum. Because it's like, whoa, hang on a minute. I mean, so much of the infrastructure here is EU funded through Natural England. And I thought, wow, we're quite dependent on that. We've got to broaden what we do. And we're a small farm, you know, we've got to find other ways to bring that kind of grant funding in. And that's been successful with that. It has been successful. And the membership side is interesting, because whilst we're not, you know, there's not 140 people here every day, we feel the support. And at our AGM, our first AGM, we had, I think, 50 people actually come, and another 30 say they gave apologies. So 70 out of 140 at that point, half our membership actively engaged in our AGM, which we were amazed with. You know, it's knowing you've got that support around you is really helpful. It doesn't make the bottom line any healthier, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But at least when we need help, we've got a pool of people that we can put feelers out to, which we've done recently, because we want to do more farmers markets to increase the beef and lamb sales. So we just put a letter out, sent it out last week. We need help. Burnham Farmers Market, got a London weekly market, Tollership, boom, boom, boom. Within 2 or 3 days, yeah, I'll help. Mm. And so we'll give people some training, and then they can then go and, you know, represent the farm and sell the beef and lamb for us on the market store.
And this model, it's a way of actually getting people out onto the land, learning land skills from whatever background, in a world, and the farming world is generally quite foreign to a lot of people,
and
quite inaccessible, and even a lot of people wouldn't even know where to start in terms of how to get in. What are you doing right here in terms of that overall objective that I think we should be following as a farming community generally, you're actually trying to actually be more outward looking and try and get more people engaged? What is working well here, and why are people coming to you?
Yeah, I mean, our volunteer program works well. So we've got maybe 6 or 8 people that have been volunteering now for, I'd say the longest person's about 7 years. And within a month or so, we skill them up and they can become really helpful. You know, it's maybe just one day a week. But you get, like on Friday, we had 8 of us working in one garden for 3 hours. So 3 8s of 24. That's 3 or 4 days work. So that works well. The work with the learning disabilities is extremely rewarding, incredibly rewarding for us and for the participants.
Yeah.
And we only started that formally in September last year. We've got 5 people coming now, just coming one's 2 days a week, everyone else is 1 day a week. Well, no, someone else is 2 days a week now as well. And just seeing the progression of those people, and they're one guy with cerebral palsy, he's came and he said, look, I don't want to be treated as a disability person. I want to get right into the heart of the business, which is what the Camp Hill model is anyway. And he's now producing handmade woolen felted bags and we're selling them £40 a shot. And he's got a waiting list of 4, you know. So if you look at it in an economic sense, he's delivering for the farm economically, socially as well. But for him as an individual, that's exactly what he wants to be. He wants to be given that opportunity to work somewhere and produce revenue for where he's working. And that's, well, that's a bit ridiculous. Funny to say, it's priceless for that for some people. And a lot of the parents, well, most of the parents that their children, well, not children, they're adults, they're coming here. They say it's so rare to find somewhere where the language doesn't change because of someone with learning disabilities in the room. And that's what I've learned from Camp Hill. It doesn't. You just treat, everyone's treated as people. And so there's like an honesty with that. And that goes well. The other thing that goes well, we have primary school visits and they're just great fun. You know, one day the school's poor, they're so strapped for cash and all the risk of coming to a farm and all that. But they go really well. They're amazing days. Schools come down from London to visit us. And we do farm walks, you know, we do educational farm walks like we did this morning. And they're simple walks, 2 hours, but sometimes they can, like the most we ever had on one is 40 people. But they can be, we charge for those now, we used to get funded for them, but we charge just a little bit for them. And that again gets people right into the farm, you know, and they walk around, they see the animals, feed the animals, but it's still a working environment. Yeah. And
From a boring practical point of view, how difficult is that in terms of insurance, in terms of paperwork, in terms of health and safety,
yeah,
all that stuff?
It's one of those things in a way, whether you're doing one visit or 50 visits, a lot of that is a one-off cost.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bureaucratic hit. you have to have the insurance, you have to have the risk assessments, and you have to plan the walk well and keep your eye on things, whether it's one or...
But once you're there...
Once you've done that...
You're pretty much set up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so when new people come on, they get an induction and they, you know, they get to know the ropes quite quickly. But the thing with this farm, you know, there's the thing with the organics and biodynamics, there's no chemicals on the farm, which is important from a health and safety side. And all our land operations are human scale. So we don't have big machines trundling around a lot of the time. If we do need big machinery... You know, I've got a few friends around with kits, and they come on a contract basis. So, in terms of farming, this farm is the risks aren't so large, yeah, as compared to say some other more mechanised farming systems. Yeah.
I'm interested in your conservation background and how that's impacted your thinking coming into a farming life.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that background and your life before Lauriston?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, when I was at college, uni and then the Y College, I was sort of one of those annoying people for mainstream agriculture who, you know, like I did a lot of work sort of, which is quite, you know, I was always standing up for wildlife as against production. And I was more heavily in that camp than I was in production camps. I didn't have a great opinion of farmers. But then I'd never been a farmer. And I think once I've been there, it's only 15 years I've been farming now, but I've actually got respect for every farmer because it's blooming hard work. It really is. It's like full on work. And you really have to sacrifice so much to do it. And there's some element, whatever the farming method, with all the farmers I've ever met, there's an element of service that you're giving. And even if you are spraying chemicals on the farm, there's something in the farmer which is common.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that when I was younger. I was just anti that sort of thing. I think what's been really interesting here for me is, and when I was doing my research for math then, was how do we integrate agriculture and conservation? How do we do that without polarising the two, without saying this is conservation on this side, that is production on that side? How do we meet? Where do we meet? And having been in the environmental world for, I don't know, 45 years now, really, I started young with this. It was such a fight, such a battle, you know, and I was on one side of the fence for a while there. And you thought, oh, my God, you know, be spitting at each other almost.
Yeah.
But I noticed with especially in this country, the way that the conservation schemes have developed, like Halvergate Marshes in Norfolk, is an amazing case study of the first time, really, that was a pilot study, that the agricultural production was valued as much as the conservation. So we have to. So then there was like an even balance. And that's come through the environmentally sensitive area scheme and now the stewardship scheme, where it's really possible now for those two aspects to come together. But still, I find it really, as well as that, though, I find it really encouraging that the EU are recognising organics as a method which doesn't need to comply, like, not getting too technical, but with all the greening rules recently.
Yeah.
You know, that if you're organic, you don't have to do all that. Because so that the EU is actually sort of, maybe they don't know what they've done, I'm sure they do, but they've actually said that by the virtue of the production method on its own, we get benefits for conservation. And that's a link which Britain hasn't made as a country yet, but the EU have made it. And that's very interesting, I think, for future policy. It kind of gives me a glimpse of what might be happening within the EU, if we're in it or not. You know, I think they'll be moving in that, recognising that the environmental benefits from organics farming, it's almost like beginning to develop a tax on non-organic farming, which is quite interesting, very interesting output. So here, I think, I mean, people, you know, most people still think we're like Rittle College come as their main agriculture course come here for the diversification module.
Yep.
So we're still, you know, of course, we're not heavy production orientated, and we never will be, whilst ever I'm here. We'll be balancing all the time. And I think as well, there are some farms that need to go further with conservation to offer a service, ecosystem service, to the farms around that aren't doing it. Like, we're the only organic farm on this side of the Blackwater River. So there's one small bit on the other side. So in a way, by us providing habitat way more than is actually economically sensible for insects, for birds, we're providing something which services a wider than just this one farm. And I think that's something which sometimes you need places which are kind of going a bit further to like redress a bit of a balance.
Let's talk about that production side.
Mm-hmm.
What have you got on the farm? What are your various enterprises? And what are you sort of, I suppose, what are you prioritising?
Yeah, I mean, in agricultural output, in food output, we have, we run Shetland cattle and North Romansey sheep, both rare breeds, both slow growing. So again, not that economic in some ways. But once you get going with them, I mean, we take the cattle, they mature at 40 months. So I actually take them at about 4 years. And the quality of the meat is unrivaled, you know, when you get to take an animal to that age. So we sell that directly from the farm. It's frozen, we get it butchered at the abattoir, and then we sell it through farmers' markets as well.
Which abattoir are you using?
For the cattle, we use STM down in Sussex.
Okay.
So which is in about an hour and 20 minutes from here. The reason being is that for the sheep, we use a little one in Little Clacton, which is tiny. Yeah,
Byfords, they're just everywhere from me.
And they're fantastic, but they won't take cattle over 40 months because you still have to take the spine out and get it tested for BSE, and they haven't got the lifting equipment. So we go a little bit further for them. Still a very small abattoir, though, and very few kills. So I trust them both.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and again, the lamb is sold from the farm and through markets. We also do quite a bit with the fleeces. So we process the fleeces into knitting yarn, which we sell. It's only like, we make maybe just £3 a ball, but that's 7 balls per sheep. So that's like 21 quid from the yarn, from the fleece. And we're also getting a relationship with another organic farm that makes socks, organic socks, and they're looking for organic fleeces, you know, so we're selling raw fleece to them as well. And we make sheepskin rugs from the rams that go for meat. So that's the sort of meat side. And then we've got an acre of veg down, sort of intensive bed system, not field scale. And that's proving, it's the first year, last year was the first year we've done that scale. And I never appreciated how little vegetable production happens in this area. So the demand is nuts. So we're doubling it this year. You know, it's insane. We just can't grow enough at the moment. We do 40, got up to 40 weekly bags, plus two farm shops, plus a market, one monthly market. Within one season, this Dutch couple have joined us. They're amazing. They're 60 years combined experience in biodynamic horticulture, and they're just vroom.
Yeah, but you just can't meet demand.
No. So we've got a waiting list.
Which is a good thing in some ways.
It is, yeah. So we're doubling it this year.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so there's that's high quality vegetables, really high quality output. Going back to that Belgian chap I met all those years ago, he's absolutely right, because I can, going on to the meat, the neck chops only have, I don't know, like a 50p size of meat on them because the sheep are so small. But if I have two of those for a meal, that's enough, you know, which is crazy. But there's something in the produce which, and anybody that has the veg, they'll tell you the same. There's some life in that food which they've not experience before, and we know that's the biodynamic method. We know it. So we also sell hay. So we're actually supplying another biodynamic farm in the Isle of Mull.
Wow.
Which is local.
Just down the road.
Yeah. So they wow. Yeah, they buy hay from us, and that's a rolling contract, which is great. Yeah. So they're our main outputs, if you like, in terms of production. Yeah.
Before we get out into the sunshine, go for a wander. Let's do the 1 minute soapbox, which
I
keep on saying that this is a new thing. It's now becoming rapidly not a new thing, because it's been several episodes we've done it now. But do you have a topic in mind? You can pick anything at all. It can be to do with farming. It can be to do with anything that's not farming.
I don't know if I dare say what I want to say. Yeah. No, we've been working with Natural England for 35 years.
Yeah.
You know, back in the days of the Nature Conservancy Council, you know, right back. And we've always had an amazing relationship with them. They've been really supportive, and I think they recognise that we're not a solely production-orientated farm.
Oh, great. You're going to talk about Natural England for a minute then? That would be really interesting.
Okay.
Yeah? You ready?
Oh, I see.
Yeah. All set, and your time starts now.
Okay, so we've been working with Natural England in their various names for over 35 years now on this farm. And we've had a really, really good relationship with them over that time. I think they've appreciated that we're not a solely production-orientated farm. However, what I've seen in the last 2 years in particular is it feels to me like a systematic pulling apart of Natural England. And it actually started with austerity. So many of their good people left. And the good people that were left became debt collectors. And they left as well. And
20 seconds.
Now, we haven't been paid since June last year. And we are really struggling financially for it. And the person responsible is Michael Gove. And yet he's telling us that in the future, more of our funds come through that route. Blimey. Perfect. That was close.
Let's go for a walk round.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, so this is the vegetable field at the moment. It's 1 acre. Do you want to meet Andre?
That'd be great. Andre, what did this field look like when you started?
Well, similar to this here, all grass.
Yeah, so it's been a complete transformation.
Yeah, we've ploughed it in the autumn 1.5 years ago.
And has the soil changed over that time?
Yeah, a small amount. I mean, the soil was quite fertile from its own. It was full with worms.
Yeah.
So it was a very nice start. It was quite hard. We first had to subsoil it and then plough it afterwards. And then we just left it till spring, and then we power harrowed it first. And then I continued making these raised beds with the Trackmaster.
Spencer, what's the history of this field?
arable until about 1990, but previous to that, go back a bit further, so go back pre-1972, and it was old salt marsh as well.
Ah, really?
Yeah, okay. So it would have alluvial deposits in it,
yeah.
Which is why we've got a fair bit of topsoil over the farm, isn't it? I mean, it comes and goes a bit, but it's a good sort of alluvial. So it's got a clay in it, and it can get hard, but it's also got a lot of sand in it as well.
Yeah, it's quite nice.
It's quite an interesting soil, yeah.
Yeah, so we've got the National Coastal Footpath, which is in the news and probably on some listeners' radars. I was just saying to Spencer, actually, in my local area, around Hanford Water, the reality is that actually there's not much change in terms of the route. How's the Blackwater affected?
Yeah, I think most of it's now designated. It's sort of been laid, the path is in place. In fact, I think our side of the coast was one of the first ones in Essex that got finished, got signed off. Fortunately, there's no interference with us at all. The new coastal footpath follows the existing footpath on the top of the seawall. And there's no spreading, so there was this sort of idea that you could spread down the seawall land side and also down into the salt marsh,
yep.
Which for us here would have a big negative impact on the birds that we're trying to attract. And I've seen it myself, that the geese, we see the geese in front of us here, they will be disturbed by human activity.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of redshank nesting on the footings of the seawall near the Borough Dyke. And so, thank goodness, Natural England supported us and said, no, the new path only stays on the existing footpath. Yeah.
Disturbance, I think, is one of those strange things, isn't it? I was talking to someone in the RSPB about this. Actually, if you have a constant stream of people, it will actually be less impact than just the odd person here or there.
Exactly, yeah. We've noticed that, exactly that, yeah. That you sort of just one person on their own can actually sometimes disturb more birds if they're in a different place than, say, a group of 15 people walking around the seawall following the path. Yeah.
Have you got many footpaths across the farm?
There's just the one around the seawall, and then there's another one that goes sort of right through the middle of the barns. Which goes through one other paddock. So.
Yeah.
But touch wood, so far we've not really had any problems, only maybe twice we've had problems with dogs and sheep on the three grazer seawall.
Yeah.
But I learned very quickly to get the sheep off the seawall around public holidays.
Okay.
Because we get, especially over Christmas, there's a lot of people that come down from maybe London or other parts of the country where they're not so used to the importance of keeping your dog on a lead. Mm-hmm. And had a couple of incidents.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Fortunately, no damage. So. Yeah, to the sheep.
Where's the farmers below sea level?
Just these low ways.
Okay.
In this field. Probably. Where we were sitting earlier was about 4 metres above sea level.
Yeah.
Hey, Mary. You all right, love?
How are you affected in... Was it 2013? Was the last...
Oh, that surge?
Last major surge?
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't think much was going to happen until I got a call at 8 o'clock that night from one of my neighbours to say, right, Norfolk's flooded. So, okay. Better get moving then.
Yeah.
So we just pulled the animals up off the marsh and so they could open up a few gates so they could move to higher ground. And I think the high tide was around midnight time, wasn't it? Maybe 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
And at 2 hours before high tide, the water was only 18 inches from the top of the wall. I was like, shit, this is going to be serious. It's a very funny feeling. But then it never moved from there because the surge had got ahead of the high tide by that point.
Yeah.
But it was probably similar to where you were, was it?
It was. Yeah. But 2011, 2013 and 2017 to a lesser extent. But yeah. Thankfully, we haven't had another 1953 yet.
Yeah.
It does seem like it's...
Well, it's interesting because this wall was raised about a metre, I think 1.2 metres after 1953. And without that...
Yeah, so actually, if you think, yeah,
no
on 93-53 levels...
Yeah.
We would have actually had many of those.
Yeah.
That was Spencer Christie walking with me around his farm on the Essex coast. Next time, join me to talk pumpkins, Christmas trees and diversification with Guy and Emily French on their farm near Colchester. In the meantime, thank you for listening to this episode of Meet the Farmers. You can catch the last 10 episodes on iTunes and all previous episodes on thinkingcountry.com. Please do subscribe to the podcast, and if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends and family all about it. I'll look forward to you joining me next time.